One of the basic principles of Freemasonry is charity, in its sense of relieving the wants of others, and it has been one of the motivating forces in Freemasonry from its earliest days. Indeed, there are those today who believe that Freemasonry originated in the late 16th and 17th centuries as part of a self-help movement. By the time purely non-operative lodges emerged, regular attendance at lodges and paying dues into the box guaranteed members assistance in times of hardship or illness, with added assistance to dependents if a member should die. Once Freemasonry became organized after the formation of Grand Lodge in 1717, this system of casual relief was to continue as a feature of lodge life. It still continues today, with many lodges having their own benevolent funds from which immediate relief can be given to members or their dependents. With the beginnings of a formalized Grand Lodge administration in 1723, attention was turned to the formation of a centralized charity fund. At the quarterly communication held on the 21st of November 1724, the Earl of Dalkeith proposed that each lodge should take up a collection to be sent to Grand Lodge to form a joint stock for charitable purposes, and that a treasurer should be appointed to administer it. Grand Lodge appointed a committee to make recommendations. On the 25th of November 1725, the committee made its report, which was adopted. 2 years after that, at the quarterly communication of 25th of November 1729, representatives of the lodges present were called over to pay their lodges' contributions to the charity fund. The fund was augmented a month later by a new regulation instituting a fee of 2 guineas payable to the charity by every new lodge for its constitution. The Committee of Charity was not in any way independent. Whilst it could give immediate relief up to a grant of 5 guineas, it had to keep minutes of each meeting, which had to be presented to and approved by the next quarterly communication. Any grant over 5 guineas could not be dispensed without the approval of the Grand Lodge. A significant widening of the brief of the Committee of Charity took place on the 13th of December 1733, when it was resolved that the pressure of business at quarterly communications having become so great, all matters pertaining to the administration of the craft should first be discussed by the Committee of Charity, who would then report on them and make recommendations to Grand Lodge. Thus, the Committee of Charity not only dispensed charity, but also acted as a general committee and policy-making body. The same situation occurred with the Ancients' Grand Lodge. Once established, it instituted registration fees and quarterly dues from members, a portion of which was automatically transferred to a charitable fund. A steward's lodge was set up to consider applications and, like the opposition's Committee of Charity, it soon found itself with the power to act as a reporting committee, board of inquiry, and policy-making body. In the provinces, local charities were developed, particularly to assist those who fell ill at a time when there was no welfare state or free medical services. In 1799, a National Masonic Benefit Society was set up with the agreement of the Premier Grand Lodge. Members paid an annual fee of 1 guinea, in return for which they were guaranteed medical fees and a subsistence allowance in time of sickness. The scheme proved very popular, so much so that by 1830, the possible claims against the Benefit Society's fund so outweighed its assets and income that it had to be wound up. The Royal Masonic Institution for Girls was the brainchild of the Chevalier Bartholomew Ruspini. An Italian surgeon-dentist, Ruspini arrived in England in 1759 and began to practice in Bath and London. He began to discuss the idea of a Masonic charity to support the daughters of indigent or deceased brethren with some of his friends in 1787. And on the 28th of March 1788, his committee first met to plan for a school. They worked quickly, and within 9 months had purchased a property in Somers Place East between the present Euston and St Pancras stations, converted it into a school, and installed 15 girls between the ages of 5 and 10 years under a matron and domestic staff. Ruspini's profession had brought him into contact with many members of the royal family, and the Grand Master, the Duke of Cumberland, and his wife were persuaded to become patrons of the new charity, which was named in their honour the Royal Cumberland Freemasons School. The girls were well looked after, but the regime was somewhat Spartan. By 1795, the school had outgrown Somers Place East and removed to St George's Fields, now Westminster Bridge Road, where it remained until 1852, when a purpose-built school was provided at Clapham, which enabled 250 girls between the ages of 7 and 16 to be looked after. By 1920, the school had again outgrown its facilities, and there was no further room for expansion at Clapham, which was felt, by then, had become a less desirable area for a girls' school. The decision was made to move out of London altogether, and the search for a suitable site resulted, in 1926, in the purchase of Rickmansworth Park, Hertfordshire. The enterprise was crowned on the 27th of June 1934, when the school was formally opened by Her Majesty Queen Mary. The post-war years, the development of the welfare state, and changing social attitudes had their effect on the girls' school. The provision of out-education grants and the better provision of state education gradually led to a preference for girls being educated locally rather than boarding at the school. In 1965, with places being available at the school, agreement was given to the introduction of fee-paying girls, often the daughters of Freemasons in the services or government offices whose careers took them abroad for long periods. In the 1970s, the school became an independent school, with places reserved for girls assisted by the institution. Although the original aim of the institution was simply to clothe and educate the girls until they reached the age of 16 and were able to take charge of their own lives, the system was expanded to one of taking a paternalistic interest in the welfare of the girls for the remainder of their lives. Nowadays, girls who go on to further education continue to be assisted until their formal education ceases. Girls who do not wish to go on to further education are given assistance in finding vocational training or suitable jobs, and guidance and any necessary assistance continues until they are settled. Once formal assistance ceases, the institution does not lose interest in the girls, who know that the institution is there to help or advise them if problems arise. The Royal Masonic Institution for Boys had a double foundation due to the existence of the two Grand Lodges in England before 1813. The first boys' charity was formed in July 1798 by William Burwood, Junior Grand Warden of the Ancients Grand Lodge in 1789, and members of the United Mariners Lodge, now number 30. Unlike Ruspini and the founders of the girls' school, the founders of the boys' charity had no intention of starting a school, but simply wished to provide clothing and tuition fees for the sons of indigent or deceased Freemasons. The plan quickly gained support of the Ancients Grand Lodge, with the Grand Master, the Duke of Athol, becoming the charity's patron in 1801, and the Grand Lodge making annual grants to the charity from 1803. From an initial 6 boys in 1798, the charity had become responsible for 55 boys by 1813. A curious situation arose in 1808. Sir Francis Columbine Daniel, who had been a member under both Grand Lodges and a founder of the Ancients Boys' Charity, had been expelled by the Ancients, resulting in him devoting all his energies to the Royal Naval Lodge, now number 59. With the support of his lodge, Daniel instituted a boys' charity for the Premier Grand Lodge. Like the Ancients' charity, there was no intention of forming a school, money raised being used to clothe and out-educate boys. Although the two Grand Lodges were united in 1813, it was not until 1816 that the two boys' charities became one under the patronage of the Grand Master, His Royal Highness the Duke of Sussex. The institution continued to clothe and out-educate the boys, and when, in 1830, the idea of building a school was raised, it was peremptorily dismissed by the Grand Master, who gave it as his opinion that the money donated by the brethren was for the support of the boys and not to be wastefully expended on supporting bricks and mortar. The desire for a school did not disappear, however, and in 1852 a building fund was instituted, leading in 1856 to the purchase of a property in Lordship Lane, Wood Green. 45 of the boys cared for by the institution were moved to Wood Green in 1857, and in 1863 the foundation stone of new school buildings was laid. Further building took place in 1865, enabling the school to house 100 boys. By 1890, the school was looking after 260 boys. It had become clear that the Wood Green property had outlived its usefulness, and that no space was available for expansion, necessary to provide suitable accommodation to teach the boys scientific and technical subjects. In 1896, agreement was reached to purchase for £13,000 the Bushy Grove estate near Watford. Work began on the new school at Bushy in 1900, and the new buildings were completed by October 1902, and the school moved from Wood Green to Bushy for the start of the new term in January 1903. A large increase in the number of boys receiving assistance as a result of the First World War led to consideration being given to build a separate junior school. Suitable premises were found in the manor estate at Bushy. Work was completed by 1929, when 400 boys were admitted. The expansion of the 1920s was not maintained. The junior school was never fully used after the Second World War, and in 1969 the decision was taken to transfer the remaining juniors to the senior school, and from September 1970 the two were merged into one school. This proved only a temporary measure. Continually rising costs and a preference for out-education forced the council in 1975 to recommend that the school be closed. The recommendation, after much spirited and often very public debate, was accepted, and the school finally closed in 1977. The work of the institution, however, did not cease, but returned to its original form of supplying grants to clothe and educate the boys. From 1975, all boys accepted by the institution were placed in schools approved by the Board of Management. As with the girls, interest in the boys did not cease once they had finished their schooling. In 1922, the Masonic Boys Welfare Fund was established to provide benefits for the boys once they had left either Bushy or the school in which the institution had placed them. In the words of one of the institution's own publications, the fund does a great deal of quiet and unostentatious work in assisting ex-pupils to establish themselves in their chosen careers at a time when their earned income is usually very small. The formation of the Royal Masonic Benevolent Institution was fraught with difficulties. As early as 1830, it had been suggested that some form of institution with residential facilities should be formed to take care of aged brethren. But it was not until Dr. Robert Crucifix took up the idea in his periodical The Freemasons' Quarterly Review that any action was taken. Crucifix advocated the funding of an asylum for aged and decayed Freemasons, and met with a group of like-minded friends on the 22nd of June 1835 to organise a committee to manage the setting up of such a fund. Unfortunately, they began to arrange matters, including a festival, before gaining the support of Grand Lodge, and more importantly, the Grand Master. When the committee petitioned the Grand Master for his support, he replied that as he had no official cognizance of the committee, and as it had not been constituted by any Masonic authority, he could not give it his support. The committee tried to get themselves put on a proper footing, but unfortunately misrepresented a public statement of the Grand Master, and for a period of 4 years the two sides gradually grew farther and farther apart, the situation reaching a climax with Crucifix being suspended from his Masonic privileges for 6 months, and the Grand Master stating publicly that he did not believe the aged would best be served by the provision of an asylum, the upkeep and staffing of which would be a perpetual drain on the institution's finances, but that a system of annuities would be a more proper way of disbursing the money subscribed. Despite the official objections, the asylum project met with general approval, and festivals and other entertainments were held to swell the subscriptions donated by the brethren. The Grand Master counteracted this by persuading Grand Lodge in 1842 to set up the Royal Masonic Benevolent Annuity Fund, financed by quarterly donations of £100 from the Fund of Benevolence. By 1847, sufficient funds had been raised to choose a site at Croydon and ask architects to produce schemes for housing 50 occupants. Unfortunately, after such a long battle, Crucifix did not live to see the opening of the asylum in 1850. By 1849, many of those who had been involved in the early disagreements, including the Grand Master, had died or ceased Masonic activity. Common sense prevailed, and discussions took place to promote an amalgamation of the asylum scheme and the Grand Lodge annuity scheme. In May 1850, the two united to form the Royal Masonic Benevolent Institution for aged Freemasons and their widows. The new institution continued the work of its two forerunners, taking over the management of the asylum at Croydon and gradually enlarging it, and continuing to grant annuities to those who did not wish to or could not be accommodated in the asylum. It is in the last 30 years that the Benevolent Institution has really come into its own, with the development of residential accommodation in various parts of England and Wales. In 1947, Harwood Court at Hove in Sussex came into existence, providing self-contained flats and communal areas, a pattern which was to be repeated with every development. By 1994, the Benevolent Institution had 15 homes running, with new projects already in the planning stage. The last of the Masonic charities to be formed was the Royal Masonic Hospital. This had its origins in the First World War, when the Hospital for Women in Fulham Road was bought and opened as the Freemasons' Hospital and Nursing Home to care for the war wounded. When peace returned, it was clear that the hospital could meet a real need within the craft, and the decision was made to build a hospital. A site was found at Ravenscourt Park in West London, and fundraising began in earnest. The building was completed and officially opened on the 12th of July 1933 by King George V, accompanied by Queen Mary, who announced that it was to be known as the Royal Masonic Hospital. The hospital reverted to its original status as a war hospital in 1939, and over 8,000 servicemen were given treatment. When the National Health Service came into being in 1948, the hospital was not taken over by the state and has continued ever since as a private hospital. Although extensions had been built in the 1950s, it was clear by 1968 that the operating theatres and equipment of the hospital needed replacing. Economic problems have continued, however, and in 1984 serious consideration began to be given to the question of disposing of the hospital and creating a new charity to give assistance to the sick in their own localities, rather than bringing them to Ravenscourt Park. A meeting of governors of the hospital turned down the proposal to sell, and the discussions continued and sadly became more acrimonious. By early 1994, the charity commissioners had stepped in and appointed a receiver and manager to try and sort out the hospital's finances and to decide whether or not it had a viable future. General care of the sick was taken out of the hands of the hospital in 1990, when the new Masonic Samaritan Fund was established to provide assistance with medical care not only at the Royal Masonic Hospital, but at any hospital which provided the best care at reasonable cost and most conveniently to the patient. The three great Masonic charitable institutions were conceived of and funded independently of Grand Lodge. They relied totally on the generosity of individual brethren and lodgers for their financial stability. The girls, being the oldest, set the pattern for fundraising, which was to be followed by the two junior institutions. In 1789, to mark the first anniversary of the girls' school, a church service followed by a festival dinner was held. Collections were taken at both, benefiting the school fund by £82, 10 shillings and 6 pence. The anniversary festival became an annual event for all three institutions. Initially, money was raised by collections at the church service and dinner, but it soon became formalised into a system whereby a prominent Freemason was invited to be festival chairman, and brethren throughout the country were invited to be festival stewards by payment of a minimum donation and a steward's fee. The three annual festivals became even more formalised in the mid-19th century, when the present system was adopted of inviting a provincial grandmaster to be festival chairman, with enough notice for his province to work for 5 or 7 years towards raising increasingly enormous sums of money for their festival. The festival collection would not be limited to donations from the sponsoring province, but would include donations from other provinces, London lodges, and lodges abroad under the United Grand Lodge of England. Apart from the festival collections, the only income the institutions received is derived from fixed grants from Grand Lodge, individual donations and legacies, and investment income. The system is far from satisfactory. The principal source of income is the annual festival, and as this depends largely on the size of the sponsoring province, annual income can fluctuate wildly, and financial planning is made difficult by the lack of knowledge of what the next year's income will be. Despite the existence of the independent charities, Grand Lodge did not neglect its duties. As we have seen, the two Grand Lodges which existed before 1813 each had their own central charity funds controlled by the Grand Lodge. After the union of the two Grand Lodges, a Board of Benevolence was set up to deal with petitions for charity. It was funded by an agreed percentage of the annual dues, which each member paid for every lodge to which he belonged, being set aside in a separate fund of benevolence. Meeting monthly, the board's purpose was to aid petitioners, their widows, and children from any recognised constitutions. As we shall see, it also had authority to recommend grants for non-Masonic purposes and give annual fixed sums to the three institutions. The Masonic charities evolved to fill specific needs and serve their various purposes admirably. With the growing development of the welfare state, the introduction of the National Health Service, and the great improvement in state education, a number of brethren began to question whether the charities were serving a useful purpose or were simply duplicating state facilities. Foremost amongst those who believed that the time had come for a major investigation into the charities and a reappraisal of their functions was the present Grand Master, His Royal Highness the Duke of Kent. In June 1971, the Grand Master's intention of setting up a wide-ranging committee of inquiry into the Masonic charities and their funding, under the chairmanship of Mr. Justice Bagnall, was announced. The committee took submissions from and inquired into the charities themselves, but also took a great deal of oral and written evidence from lodges and individual brethren of all ranks within the craft. They also examined how comparable non-Masonic charities were organised and funded. Their work took a considerable amount of time, and their report was not presented to the Grand Master until 1974. He accepted in principle the recommendations of the Bagnall Report and set up a steering committee to implement them. The Grand Master's committee began its work immediately, but its task was not an easy one. As the institutions and hospital were autonomous bodies with royal charters and charitable status, there were many legal difficulties to be sorted out, and some changes in the Bagnall Report's suggestions had to be made to satisfy the charity commissioners. Additionally, it must be admitted, there was a certain reluctance in some quarters to agree to change. The craft has always had an emotional reaction to changes in the charities, and whilst it was acknowledged that changes needed to be made, there were those who would rather have some alterations in the existing charities than the major reorganisation which resulted from the Bagnall Report. Many of the problems were solved, however, and the new charities have come into existence as follows. The trust deed of the Foundation for the Aged and Sick was signed on the 28th of November 1979, but for complicated legal reasons, largely a result of the hospital remaining a general hospital rather than specialising in geriatric cases, the benevolent institution of the hospital remains separate and will do so until the future of the hospital is decided. The Grand Charities Trust Deed was signed on the 16th of April 1980, and it began its work on the 1st of January 1981, when the duties and assets of the former Board of Benevolence were transferred to it. Independent of Grand Lodge, its controlling body is the General Meeting, the membership of which is composed of those qualified to attend Grand Lodge. Its work of dealing with petitions, considering grants to Masonic charities, and the dispensing of non-Masonic charity is carried out by a council and its petitions committee. The Masonic Trust for Girls and Boys Trust Deed was signed on the 8th of September 1982. The complete amalgamation of the Boys and Girls institutions was delayed because of peculiar legal and practical complications. The complete merger of the Boys and Girls into the Trust took place on the 1st of January 1986. The Trust has significantly widened the scope of assistance given to the children of distressed or deceased Freemasons, and, for the first time, will allow assistance to be given, funds permitting, to any child, regardless of whether or not its father was a Freemason, and grants to be made to any charity established for the benefit of distressed children. The Grand Master is Grand President of all three charities, each of which is presided over by a president appointed by the Grand Master, which office is an active office in Grand Lodge. The charities each have their own councils, composed of members appointed by the Grand Master and elected by London and the provinces. Each has its own annual festival, sponsored by the provinces in rotation, the first of which took place in 1986. Contrary to public opinion, Masonic charity is not solely directed at Freemasons and their dependents. The records show a long tradition of non-Masonic charity dating back to 1733, when the Deputy Grand Master recommended that masters and wardens of all lodges should make a collection amongst themselves to assist the trustees for the settlement of the American colony of Georgia, to send distressed persons to Georgia where they may be comfortably provided for. From that time onwards, grants were regularly made to help those suffering the effects of natural disasters both at home and abroad, to assist national charities, and to ameliorate the effects of war. Freemasonry has had a long connection with the Royal National Lifeboat Institution, providing assistance in setting up lifeboat stations and paying for 10 lifeboats, the last of which was presented in 1980 and named in honour of Her Royal Highness the Duchess of Kent. Until recently, the major non-Masonic charitable effort was made in 1967 as part of the celebrations of the 250th anniversary of the formation of Grand Lodge. The then Grand Master, the Earl of Scarborough, suggested providing a major fund for medical research. As a result, over £600,000 was raised and formed into a trust, the income of which is administered by the Royal College of Surgeons. Over the years, the income has been used to provide laboratories and specialised equipment and to pay the salaries of specialist researchers, principally into heart disease and cancer. The income from the trust is still being administered by the Royal College. The new Grand Charity is now the principal dispenser of grants to non-Masonic charities and organisations. At the end of each year, some £300,000 is dispensed in sums from £500 to £5,000 to national charities concerned with welfare and medical research, covering all types of mental and physical disabilities. To mark the link, direct or indirect, between Freemasonry and operative stonemasons, donations of £5,000 have been given to the restoration funds of the great Anglican cathedrals of England and Wales. Each year, the Grand Charity selects two or three projects to receive major awards, usually in the order of £250,000 over periods of 3 to 5 years. Major grants have gone to university medical research centres, the Great Ormond Street Children's Hospital, Crisis at Christmas, Age Concern and Help the Aged, and to train Cancer Relief Macmillan nurses. In the last 10 years, over £1.25 million has gone to hospices throughout England and Wales. To celebrate the 275th anniversary of Grand Lodge and the Grand Master's 25th anniversary, over £2 million was set aside to enable cottage and rural enterprises to establish a community for the handicapped at Rowden, Wiltshire, and to assist the Home Farm Trust, Camp Hill Village Trust, and Elizabeth Fitzroy Homes in their work of enabling the mentally and physically handicapped to live a full life within the community. In addition to the centralised charities, many provincial Grand Lodges and individual lodges have their own benevolent funds. And just as the Grand Charity supports Masonic and non-Masonic cases, so provincial and lodge benevolent funds will support both. In addition to the Grand Charity contribution, which forms part of his Grand Lodge dues, the individual Freemason, provided it does not overstrain his personal or family commitments, can contribute to the central charities by covenant. In many lodges, it's the custom to take a charity collection either at the end of the meeting or at the festive board, and it is usually up to the master how each collection is disposed of. In many lodges, it's the custom for one collection a year, often at a meeting near Christmas, to be given to the local hospice, hospital, or children's home. Charity is not solely concerned with money, but also involves the giving of time and practical assistance. Many lodges and individual Masons give freely of their time to local charities, visiting those who are sick or disabled, arranging events for children's homes, and entertaining the elderly and housebound. Often, both the financial and the practical help is given without any attendant publicity, in the true spirit of charity. But the uninformed criticisms of Freemasonry's detractors have forced the bushel to be at least lifted up from the light, if not totally removed. Sadly, criticism of Freemasonry in general has been very much a factor in Masonic life over the last decade. But that must be the subject of our next chapter.